Welcome to Interleaved, where we take a deep dive into topics from the Daf Yomi with modern-day sages of the Torah and the world. I'm Netanel Zelis Pillay. On today's episode, Life in the Fast Lane.
What happened? What's next? Let's get on with the story.
In just a few short months, hundreds of thousands of Jews around the world will gather, hopefully in person, to read Megillat Esther on the holiday of Purim. In many of these gatherings, people of all gender identities will read the Megillah. And many hundreds of the people who will be reading Megillah learn to do so from our guest today. Rabbani Bracha Jaffe serves as the Associate Rabbah at the Hebrew Institute of Riverdale in Bronx, New York. A 2017 graduate of Yeshivat Maharat, she has taught many people to Lane and is the voice of the Jofa Megillat Esther and Megillat Rut apps. Rabbani Bracha, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Netanel. I'm so excited to be here.
So excited to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us. So before we get into the daf, I want to hear a little bit about you. What called you to the rabbinate, rabbinic leadership? What's your journey?
My whole family loved davening and laning. We always spoke about shul. My brothers, I have three brothers, who all learned laning for their bar mitzvah, which interested me, but I stopped because there was nothing to do with it. Many years later, fast forward, living in Israel, in Ranana, as a high-tech computer person, I had a long high-tech career in Israel. A woman in Ranana who knows how to lane, was taught as a young girl by her father, opens up a course for laning for women, and women just flock to it. And I was around 40 years old, and my inspiration was Rabbi Akiva. I thought to myself, Rabbi Akiva learned how to read Hebrew at age 40. I could learn how to read and how to lane at age 41. That was my inspiration. And I would say from the second I got to that course, it was clear how much I fell in love with it. You know, some people do all their chores, finish up, clean up. I had four children. I was dealing with my household, working full time. And some people finish everything and then sit down to watch a TV show or something else to relax. I would finish up everything and sit down to practice laning, because I knew that if I sat down to practice laning earlier in the evening, I would not get up because I loved it so much. That was laning from the Torah. I say that that is what brought me to the rabbinate, because for me, this unlocked a secret garden that had been closed to me for many years. Learning how to lane, learning the diyuk, the precision of laning, the singing, knowing how to fit the cantillation notes to the words just gave me such joy. And knowing that I could do it and finding that I had a skill for it, especially if I kept practicing, gave me great joy. That led me to opening up options for teaching girls how to lane, because there was nobody else in Ranana who taught girls how to lane. And then I taught women how to lane, and I sometimes taught boys how to lane, and people started turning to me with questions. And slowly this led to people asking me how to do bat mitzvahs. And then I ran bat mitzvah programs, all this while I was still in computers. It didn't lead me to a coaching course, but I did that as well. All of this happened at the same time that I was starting to feel dissatisfaction with high tech, not because I didn't like the work, but it didn't fill my soul. And about almost 10 years ago, I ended up coming to the States for a completely different reason. But less than a year after I came to the States, an opportunity opened up. And in coaching, we say that mazal, luck, is the corner of opportunity and availability. I was available and the opportunity happened. The head of Yeshivat Maharat, the founder of Yeshivat Maharat, Rabbi Sarah Hurwitz, approached me one Shabbat. I was in her community, so she knew me. She knew I was a woman who loved learning. She walked out of shul, walked across the lobby, didn't say hello to anyone, looked me in the eye and said, Bracha, have you ever thought of going to Yeshivat Maharat? And the second she said that, the whole world disappeared and it was just me and Rabbi Sarah and a shaft of light from God, and everything disappeared. I couldn't breathe. I was on fire. I knew this is what I wanted to do, and my circumstances allowed me to do it.
Wow.
And I'll add one more thing. I had the zchut, the honor, the privilege of teaching my grandson in Israel over Zoom this past year for his bar mitzvah. And I was, thank God, in Israel. I'm an Israeli citizen. I lived in Israel most of my life. I was able to be there for the bar mitzvah, and I taught him his laning and his haftorah. And there's just, it's a little hard to explain how that just hits all the boxes. And
oh my gosh, I'm sure. That's so special.
Really, really, really special. And the best part was after every lesson, he would say, Todarabah, Safti. Thank you, Safti. I enjoyed it so much. So
Beautiful. What was the first thing you learned to lane?
I learned to lane an aliyah in Parshat Tetzaveh. There was a women's tefillah group opening in Ra'anan at the time. I guess that's probably why she opened the course. I really didn't think about it until it opened, but one thing led to another. And then at one point she said, I think you ladies are ready to lane. And my heart dropped. It's a big deal to lane. It's a really big deal. You're laning before God, before people. You're reading from a Sefer Torah. I'd never been up close to a Sefer Torah before. I laned, I think it was Chamishi. I'd have to open up Tetzaveh to see. But it was not a trivial aliyah. And I practiced my heart out. Torah trup and then Haftorah. And it became my personal bucket list. I didn't even know I had a bucket list, but my bucket list was to learn every type of trup there is, every type of cantillation notes that there are. Megillah, Echa, Esther.
Tehillim?
So not Tehillim. That's not even on my bucket list, but the special one for Rosh Hashanah, that's my next one.
Amazing.
Just learning all of the trup. So it's something I love. I could talk about laning all day. I'm such a laning nerd. I really honestly say proudly that I'm a laning nerd.
I love it. Thank you so much for sharing that with me. It just really reminds me how much of a privilege it is to be able to read Torah, to be so close up with it, and the privilege that as a man I take for granted. You know, like, it was obvious to me. I was at my bar mitzvah, I was going to lane the Torah. And the fact that you're empowering people, all people, to lane is just so, so, so important and incredible.
Yeah, for those who want it, especially. I actually believe that everybody should learn trup whether you lane or not, because it helps parse the psukim, the verses. It's part of our heritage, something that everybody should learn it and know how to do it. So that when you're in shul and you hear somebody lane, I think it's the same way we know if somebody is pronouncing the words correctly. I think it's good to know if they're also singing it somewhat correctly. So I think everybody should learn it. I once had a dream to travel around Israel before I attended rabbinical school. I once had this dream that I would just go from seminary to seminary, from high school to high school, and just teach trup all around the country, because I have taught it so many times and I never tire of it, ever. I'm lucky that way. I don't get to do it that much in my current job because I'm too busy. I sometimes get to do it, which is really, really nice and special. Yeah.
I 100% agree. Like, I grew up laning a lot. My dad taught me to lane so I could lane my aliyah and Simchas Torah when I was 9. But I think it's really helped me just like become really familiar with the text of the Torah. Like,
exactly. And it teaches you to pronounce correct. There's so many things that it teaches you, and it's part of our tradition and our heritage. Although I could imagine that if every woman learned it and then wasn't able to lane anywhere, she might be frustrated. But that's a separate issue. But yes, it is quite a beautiful thing to see a girl up there with her mom, maybe with her grandmother, maybe her grandmother has never, ever been so near to a Sefer Torah. Everybody should be able to see and touch and kiss the Sefer Torah once in their life, just to see what it looks like. It's the holiest object that we have. And women are often distanced from it, which is sad. So
yes to all of that. All right, let's jump into the daf. On 4a, Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi says that women are obligated to hear Megillah reading using a well-known formulation, Af hein hayu be'oto hanes. Literally, even they were in that miracle. It's kind of baffling how backhanded and reluctant this formulation is, given the fact that the Megillah is quite literally named after a woman, not to mention a woman who almost single-handedly brought about the salvation of thousands of Jews across a massive kingdom spanning 2 continents. It's almost as if the sages are trying to wrest control of the holiday of Purim and its most important obligation from the woman who invented it. So I completely understand why many women find this statement upsetting. How do you understand this?
It's interesting that you pose it as something difficult. I don't see it that way. I see it as coming from a basic assumption or a basic axiom, perhaps, a basic rule that is generally followed or thought to be followed, which is that women are not obligated in mitzvot aseh she'zman gama, in time-bound mitzvot, which if you think about it, covers a huge amount of mitzvot. Any mitzvah that is bound in some way by time, let's say not tzedakah, not charity, not gmilut chasadim, acts of kindness. There are others that we're are not time bound, but a lot of positive mitzvot, especially are time bound. This is specifically talking about time bound mitzvot. And because that is an accepted rule, I give Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi a lot of credit for saying, wait a second, don't just allow it to fall into that bucket. There's a reason. There are exceptions to the rule. Here's the exception to the rule. It's so clear. They were also rescued as well as bringing about the miracle. So I don't have a problem with it. I see it as a very positive thing and give him a lot of credit.
Thank you for that perspective. Thank you for the pushback. I always appreciate like dissenting opinions. And that's what this podcast is about. It's a Talmudic podcast.
Yeah. There you go. And for me, this is such a beautiful way of describing exactly, not of describing, but an example of where I see my boundaries and what empowers me to empower others, let's say, to read the Megillah, other women specifically, although of course men and boys learn from it as well, from the same app. But for me, it's a lot about the red lines of halacha. It's all about the red lines of halacha. So the parts that bother me is for somebody to say, well, women can't do that. Women can't make kiddush for a man. Women cannot whatever, fill in the blank, when I know that halachically it's okay. Now, you could maybe make an argument about whether women can exempt only other women or also other men, but at the very least, don't tell me that women cannot do it, because clearly halachically women can, and there are many, many poskim, many halachic decisors to rely on. That's the part that I have trouble with. I'm Orthodox, I find myself as Orthodox, and I buy into it, and I love it and accept it. I don't accept people who don't know or want to dismiss it based on, well, I never saw women do it or whatever. My grandmother didn't do it or I'm not familiar with it, but I don't even want to be familiar with it. So that's where I have trouble. I don't have trouble with Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi. I have trouble with modern people who say women can't or shouldn't.
I really appreciate that perspective. Thank you. Just as a follow-up question, given this context of the mitzvah of Megillah, the commandment of reading the Megillah, what does inclusion look like or sound like to you in the area of reading Megillah?
I would say inclusion is not only in this particular instance, but particularly perhaps in this one, is including all those who are allowed to halachically and can do it because they've put in the time to practice. So inclusion means not saying to someone, you can't or shouldn't do it. So all the voices that can contribute should contribute or should be allowed to contribute. You know what? I would even redefine it. It's just the opposite of exclusion. It's not inclusion. Would you say, for example, well, let's let this man read it. Nobody would think of that as inclusion. That would just be, so it's more about, I think, shifting the status quo so that it doesn't feel like we have to push ourselves to include, but rather this is okay. Now, again, I do understand that there would be certain societies or certain communities or congregations who would be uncomfortable having women read for a man, whether it's because they felt it wasn't halachically viable or because they were uncomfortable having a woman with Kol Isha. That's, again, it's more about understanding that not to bend over backwards to include, but learn the halacha and don't exclude.
Right. On 19b, the Mishnah rules that everyone except children, deaf people, and people with severe mental incapacitation may read the Megillah for other people. Though ostensibly this ruling includes women, there's an extensive halachic debate about whether a woman can read Megillah for a man, because some halachic authorities rule that women are only obligated to hear the Megillah, not to read it, and thus their level of obligation is on a quote-unquote lower level. This debate may be the source of the misconception in many Orthodox communities that a woman cannot read Megillah for other women, even for herself. Given this reality or context, what is it like empowering women to read Megillah?
You know, what gives me so much joy is giving women, others as well, but I guess particularly women, and particularly in this kind of setting, in Orthodox settings particularly, and in our tradition, empowering women by giving them knowledge. Women should know that they absolutely can read for themselves. They absolutely can read for other women. And there's a machloket, okay? Whether they can read for other men, I can accept that some people would and some people would not. I tell women, don't let anybody put you in a box and say you're not allowed to, because that's what reduces and diminishes women. When they think, they know, they're told, you're not allowed to, you actually have a different obligation. It is not okay to say that when it's not true. First, learn the halakha. So I think it's huge for women to hear. I want women to know, even if they never want to lane, I want them to know that they can be yotze halachically 100,000% if they go to a women's meeting. They can be proud of their daughters who want to. They can enjoy it, appreciate it in Ranana. There's a wonderful women's reading in Matan. Hundreds of women dressed up with the kids. It was so beautiful. It was so exciting, so uplifting. Such a wonderful energy and a wonderful space. And every woman there knew, we can be yotze, we can be fulfill the mitzvah, not a problem. And we are so proud of our sisters, whether sisters biologically or sisters, because we're together in the same room. We're so proud of those who took the time to do it. And they sound amazing.
100%. Yeah, that I'm all about that. Just the fact that knowledge is power.
It gives you two legs to stand on.
Yeah.
It just makes you feel you can't be pushed over. It's not power over someone, but it's about not allowing somebody else to take that power away from you.
Exactly. Yes. And I think it's just really, really important in the Jewish community, because there, you know, as in any community, as with any religion, there are things that are going to be oversimplified. There are things that are going to be sugar-coated. There are things that are going to be distorted. And there's also kind of a power structure that kind of makes people think they can't have access to these knowledge, or, you know, they don't have the skills, or so it makes them kind of reliant on rabbinic authority for this knowledge. So you giving this knowledge to people is so incredibly important. And so one of the ways you facilitated this empowerment is through your work with JOFA, the Jewish Orthodox Feminist Alliance. Can you tell us about the JOFA Megillah app and how the project came about and your very important role in it?
I'd be happy to tell you about it. I had learned in Israel to lain from the Megillah from a different friend who has the most unbelievable drop-dead voice, like literally a Broadway voice. And she's the one who taught me how, she taught me the trup, she taught me how to apply it to the words. And because I already knew trup cancellation notes from reading Torah and Haftorah, then once you learn the new nuance, it's the same exact cancellation notes, but it's different nuance in different set, in different Megillot, in different texts, then I was able to apply it. And JOFA had a tape, I guess, cassette tape, of the whole Megillah, all the Prakim, all the chapters. And it frustrated me because I heard mistakes. And I also listened to it a few times to learn, to practice. I was in America. I had already moved to the States 9 years ago, perhaps, I'm not sure when. And my sister-in-law, Judy Heiglin, who was a past president of JOFA and very much a force behind what JOFA is today, we were talking, and we were talking about the Megillah to stay up, and she knew that I'm a laning nerd, and I love all the laning, and I blamed Megillah in Israel. And we were talking about this tape, this recording the job. And I said, you know, it's really frustrating to me because it really bothers me that women will learn from it and there are mistakes in it. Mistakes in the trap or mistakes in pronouncing some of the words. That really drives me crazy. I'm really very punctilious. I'm very medekdeket. I'm very precise. I'm very exact. It bothers me when people mispronounce words. I cringe a little bit inside. Don't always say it out loud, but I cringe a little bit inside. And she said, yes, exactly. And she had this thought. She said, so we had this thought at JOFA. I didn't realize this was her thought. So this was 9 years ago. It was before apps were quite as prevalent as they are today. She said, so we had this idea to bring it into the 21st century and make it into an app. I said, that's a great idea. I said, but you absolutely must get someone, the same person, to record all 10 prakim, because on the tape, it's different women and they have different trup and that's confusing to people and some of them are better. She said, exactly. And we thought we really have to ask somebody, okay, this sounds funny coming from me. We really have to ask somebody who has a clear, good singing voice, who's very careful and precise, and will take the time to do a really good job. I said, yes. She said, well, we found that person. I said, that's great. Who is it? She said, you. I could have fallen off the chair. I was in high tech. I was whatever doing. My kids were in Israel. I was very busy anyway. I was coaching. I didn't expect her to say that. I was dumbfounded. I said, me? Really? She said, yeah. You have a really good voice. You're very clear. You read clearly. You're careful. And you care that it'll be done exactly right. I said, and I'm really busy. She said, exactly. What better person to give it to? I know you'll make time for it. Now, I really was very busy, but this was dangling a carrot in front of me that was impossible for me to say no to, because I love laning. I love singing. I love singing and laning. I love anything having to do with song and our tradition. And I really wanted it to be right. I didn't want them to create another program that had mistakes in it. So she knew that there was no way I could say no to her. And it was a huge honor. I mean, when you do something that you love and you think that you do well, and you can use it to empower others, and then somebody notices it and says, I think you're the right person. It's just a wonderful feeling that was so unexpected for me. I'm like, who am I? Why are you asking me? And there wasn't even a question. And I cannot tell you how many hours and hours and hours my husband at the time said, if I never hear Miguelette this there ever for the rest of my life, I think I heard it enough. I turned the office I was using to work for high tech for software, I turned it into a mini recording studio to the extent, because I did recordings for my work as well, I knew how to do it. I put up things to absorb echoes and I got a really good microphone. I researched it and figured out the best way to do it. I had a specific way to stand it so that it would sound similar each time I recorded. And there were two laning editors who, they were really careful. They went over everything. They found any mistakes that I made. And I loved it. I loved doing it. I didn't have time for it, but it made no difference. I found hours and hours to record and record and record over and over and over again.
Incredible. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. As someone who likes to lane and has laned, Esther is really hard to lane. It's like the cantillation, the trup sounds very similar. There's a lot of like repeating kind of phrases, and it's really long. I've never learned to lane it.
Yeah, my friend in Israel, she sent me all the cantillation notes to make sure that I had them correctly. And she said, I actually changed one of them. I said, what do you mean? She said, I changed the basic. What happened? What's next? Let's get on with the story. It was so cute. And when she taught me that, that really stuck. Yeah. Actually, I discovered while I was doing it that I didn't have all the notes exactly right. And I ended up using a similar cancellation note for two of the different tamim, two of the different trop. And I just left it like that. My laning editor said that's okay with them, even though I wouldn't do that today if I had more time. But that was one of the things that frustrated me, that I just ran out of time in the end. But they said it's fine. They had no problem with it.
So because of this app, which is so popular now, your voice is going to be iconic to a lot of our listeners, as it is to our producer, Adina, who learned to lane for the first time using your voice and the Jofa app.
Woo! Yeah.
So you must have taught countless people to lane. Do you have any like favorite stories or stories that, you know, are kind of stick out to you?
Well, I do have a few, but I'll say I always think I'm such a rock star for one day for a very small group of people. I once walked into a women's kriya. I had laned something the night before and I was visiting someone who was doing year of service or something from Israel. And I walked in, they said, oh, great, which chapter are you laning? I said, oh, I didn't know I was laning the chapter. So I did whatever chapters I had done the night before. I said, of course you're doing it. And one woman was standing there and her mouth dropped. She said, your voice sounds so familiar. You couldn't be that Bracha Jaffe who's from the Megillat Esther. I said, yes. She said, oh, I've been listening to your voice for the last 4 months. I can't get out of my head. And she ran over to two and she says, remember, I was listening. I was practicing. That's her. They're like, uh-huh, great. And they went back to whatever conversation. It didn't mean very much to them. But for her, it was very, very exciting. As I said, rock star for one day for a small group of people. I think that's really what it is that I randomly go somewhere and somebody from Europe was on actually a Jofa conference. And she said, oh, I learned from Europe. And she's like, you know, from Europe somewhere. And she had learned it. Or a man, or my Rosh Yeshiva said to me, I have been hearing your voice for the last 2 months because my teenage son is learning from the Jofa app. So I have heard you singing every single day. Like, okay. Actually, one of my favorite stories is not the Jofa app, but it's about me laning. And that was at a partnership in Yan and Ranana. My daughter and husband and two children were born at the time. My oldest granddaughter was 4 at the time, and she knows Hebrew. So for her, listening to the Megillah was a little bit like reading a story, even though she was only 4. And I was reading the Perek Vav, the 6th chapter, which is probably my favorite because it was the first one I did. I don't know. And there's twice the horse, the sus, has a trup called the Rivi'i, which goes down. And somebody taught me to do it like this. Vasus, like a neighing sound. And of course, anytime I read chapter 6, that's how I do it. And after I finished reading and I sat down next to her, she said, Safti, Safti, sus, right? Sus, like she got it. She got it. And she was 4 years old and she got it.
Wow.
It was so much fun. Yeah. So that's one of my favorite stories. But I think that knowing that so many people can learn from it, that it is so easy for them, they can do it in the privacy of their home. They can practice. They don't have to pay someone really. I mean, I'm not sure it costs to have an app on a lot of money. If it's on the phone, you can do it on the computer as well. It's actually very well done. It's easy to follow and easy to use. You can turn on the trup, the cancellation notes, you can turn them off. You can hear my voice on one word if you need it to practice over and over again.
It just
makes me happy that people can do it. It just makes me happy.
Yeah, that must be so special. The Mishnah on 21a states that two people may read the Megillah even at the same time, because Kevan de Chaviva, Yahave Datayu Vishame. Since the Megillah is dear to people, they pay attention and listen. So, though it's not quite what the Mishnah is discussing, it is common at women's Megillah readings to have multiple readers. What does having multiple Megillah readers, so what does that add to the experience?
As long as the readers do a good job, as long as the readers practice, I don't mean that they all have to have the best voices. That's never been so important to me. I mean, it's nice when people have good voices, but even as a teacher, I can tell you that even people who are flat, tone deaf, whatever you call it, they can usually rock the trup and the words and they get it right, even if they're a little off key. For me, it's all about practicing, getting the words right, getting the pronunciation and the inflection correct. I think that it creates a wonderful feeling of community. You look around, who's going to be the next one? Oh, that woman or that man, you know, if it's partnership, it splits between men and women usually. Or if it's a woman, you're like, well, you go, girl. I'm so proud of you for taking the time, taking a task that probably connected you spiritually to our heritage, preparing for it from 3 months ahead of time, doing something you probably thought you'd never do before. And it creates just a wonderful feeling of community. There's nothing wrong with one person reading the whole thing. But it becomes more boring unless that person really puts in the time to make it interesting and maybe to do voices. I have a friend in Ranana who does it with voices. He does the whole thing. He does the voices. But there's something so lovely about different people reading it. It creates a different experience from most other lanings.
For sure. Yes. Yeah, I haven't been to many Megillah readings that have multiple readers, but the few that I have been at, it was really tangible for me, palpable. You know, the sense of community created when you have multiple readers. So on a bit of a different note, one of the most hotly debated passages in Tractate Megillah is one on 23a, where the Talmud says that a woman technically may be called up to the Torah for an aliyah, or a blessing, and read the Torah for the congregation, but that the sages ruled that women may not read in the presence of men because of kvod atzibor, out of quote-unquote respect for the congregation. As a leader in a large shul, how do you grapple with this statement in terms of participation and the historical connotations of the statement?
It's a really big question.
Oh, for sure. It deserves at least one episode, if not several, to address.
No, it's okay. It just feels like that would take a while to unpack it well.
But I brought it up just because, like, I feel like I couldn't not bring it up. I just wanted to hear your thoughts generally, but
I think it opens. Okay, so here's my thought. That opens a really nice passageway for women to find spaces and places for women to be more participatory. That's the way I would answer it. And those who are willing to go in that direction and honor that can go, you know, from 1 to 10. So that's the way I would say it. That lovely that it leaves an opening and a space for halakha to step in and revive the fact that women can be more participatory.
Clearly, as we've been discussing, Megillah reading and leaning in general have changed in some ways since the times of the Talmud. and continue to change. What do you see as the future of Megillah reading?
I see that there's a nice trend, a nice solid continual climb and trend in modern Orthodox communities around the world, even communities that wouldn't allow women to take active roles in general are okay with women having women led and women reading for women only. Partnership is partnership, that's separate. And I don't know that that's going to change mainstream in shuls for women to read, you know, even if it happened in, you know, Kohelet or Root or Shir HaShirim, it would be a big deal where there's generally no bracha said and there's no particular mitzvah. At least in Israel, I know often those Megillot are read from a klef, from a scroll, and then a bracha is said beforehand. But let's put aside this one generally done for those Megillot. So in HIR, in the shul where I belong, we have mixed readings for three of the five Megillot. I don't know if things will change, but I think we're a bit more open to cultural trends than others are and willing to be open about that. I don't know that Megillah reading will change. I think it'll stay standard and traditional and emotional, as most things are. And slowly, slowly, bit by bit, little places like my daughter who learned Megillah laning and learned laning from me as well and from my teacher, she's taught Megillah laning and she brought it to Beirut Yitzchak, the kibbutz where she's living. And she taught women and spoke with the rabbi. I sent him sources because he wasn't familiar with women laning. And now they read, I don't know if they do it every year, but they've done it, I think, 2 years in a row where women lane the Megillah. I think she's done it. Yeah, I think she'll continue to lead it. So that's where I see where there are slow inroads, small little places where women can feel connected, empowered. It often carries women in communities almost the whole year, because they know that they have this special thing. And even if they have no interest in laning, they'll go off very often to women's Megillah reading because it feels so special.
Right, for sure. Oh, that's so beautiful that your daughter is teaching. Rabbi Nitracha Jaffe, thank you so much.
Oh, I was delighted to be here. Thank you for giving me an opportunity to talk about one of my passions.
Between episodes, you can keep up with Interleaved on Facebook and Twitter. If you like what you heard, follow us, leave us a review, and share this with your friends. Special thanks to our executive producer, Adina Karp. Come back next time for another deep dive.